Off the ball.
Rugby.
No, I've probably apologised for the first one. I think that's where you have to get rid of that in rugby. You know, touch shoulder to the head. But yeah, because then guys aren't going to jackal, so you know, that just, my only thing for Leo now was to say sorry for that.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With Viagra Connect 50 milligram film-coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
Now then, the World Cup kicks off this evening. A massive occasion in the US, Canada and Mexico. And we are going to look back on many of World Cups with a man who has been at many of them. This is You Had to Be There, and I'm delighted to say our guest today is George Hamilton. George, hello.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me. It's lovely to get the chance to reminisce.
Yeah, it always is. Yeah. And I mean, you've sent me over your picks. We're going to reminisce on quite a bit here, I think.
Yeah. Well, my World Cup goes back as a Belfast boy to 1958. It was the first one I remember, and Northern Ireland were in it, and it was a small-time tournament, and I was overwhelmed with excitement at the prospect of the team that I had actually seen in the flesh was actually going to be at a World Cup. But of course, we couldn't see it on TV. So everything I knew about the World Cup came through the lens of Malcolm Brodie, the sports editor of the Belfast Telegraph. The newspaper came in our door every night, and I avidly read. And that probably started me off wanting to become a sports reporter, stroke commentator. But that was where the World Cup started for me. And then there was Chile in 1962, which was on the box. There was the England World Cup, and they think it's all over. The wonderful Kenneth Wolstenholme, who was my inspiration. 1970, the Gordon Banks save. 1974, I'd lived in Germany as a student, and now I was back there looking at the, well, in my mind's eye, I was back there, but seeing it all on TV. And the final where the kickoff was held up because they didn't have the flags on the halfway line, you might recall. Jack Taylor, the Wolverhampton butcher, was the referee. And then 78, I was actually there. My very first World Cup for RTE. They were short a commentator. They had two of their own, Jimmy McGee and Philip Green. They hired Billy George from what was then the Cork Examiner. And the late, great Mike Horgan, a very good friend of mine, sports editor at the time, said, we need a fourth commentator. What about the guy who does it for BBC in Belfast? And that's where it all began.
Magic.
Magic is right.
What's your feelings when you get the call up?
Well, it came in the form of a letter from Fred Cogley, who was the head of sport at the time, who was kind of not really saying, please come with us to Argentina. He said, we were considering asking you. That this was how the letter was couched. And I was right back to the post box with a letter back saying, consider no more, I'm on board. And it went from there.
You were around 28?
28, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so you're still pretty young to be getting a call up for commentary for a World Cup.
Absolutely. I mean, my commentary experience was Northern Ireland-based. My big match had been a World Cup qualifier, funnily enough, and the kind of serendipity in that Northern Ireland were in the same group as the Netherlands, who ended up playing in the World Cup final. And Northern Ireland's first match was against the Netherlands. Danny Blanchflower was a new manager. He recalled George Best from the international wilderness. Best, of course, had retired and then come back and was playing for Fulham at the time. And BBC Northern Ireland, their head of sport wasn't there at the time. She was on holiday, Joy Williams, and her deputy did something that Joy, I don't think, would ever have done. He suggested that we show the match live on TV from Rotterdam. And it had to go to London to be okayed because there was no local opt-out available that wouldn't go across the 9 o'clock news on TV, which was sacrosanct. Mm-hmm. So London said, yes, go for it. And they read the news twice. The newsreader called Kenneth Kendall read the news at 9 o'clock for the England, Scotland and Wales, and then began at 9:30 to read it all again with a headline that Northern Ireland have drawn in Rotterdam.
Not much has changed then.
No.
In that sense. When you do get the call up, there's a lot of, I suppose, similarities between the 1978 World Cup in Argentina and probably this year's World Cup, the last World Cup in Qatar, the previous World Cup before that in Russia, in that Argentina at that time is run by a military junta.
General Jorge Videla was the man in charge, yeah.
Does that come into your mind at all whenever you're thinking, wow, great, I get to go to my first World Cup?
Yeah.
I'm going to
There was never an oh-no moment, because you've got to remember, I was living in troubled Belfast at the time. And troops on the street and security zone in the centre of the city, and open your bag as you're trying to go into a building to have it searched and checked. So I didn't think there was going to be anything more than that that I hadn't already seen before. And the thing that struck me when we actually got our own boots on the ground, so to speak, in Argentina, in Mendoza, and I noticed the police uniform was kind of military fatigues, but they didn't look like the British Army that was on the streets of Belfast in their camouflage gear. They were in smart kind of navy blue, well-pressed uniforms, but fatigues, if you know what I mean. Didn't look like they were paramilitary police at all. And I never had the impression while I was there. Now, of course, I was only scratching the surface. I had a laminate for the World Cup. I was in carefully controlled areas. There was never any suggestion in my mind that this was anywhere that wasn't a pleasant place to be. But of course, obviously, all of that was going on in the background. So no, the answer to the question is it never really crossed my mind because my own background of where I was coming from.
So this was a walk in the park for you.
Yeah, you could put it like that. I remember being interviewed on Gloria Honeyford at a programme on Radio Ulster at the time called A Taste of Honey. And she called... it was very
could
popular.
Could have been about anything.
Yeah. But she called me because I was the local boy who was now in Argentina at the World Cup. And it was a big deal back then to have somebody local at the World Cup. I mean, Northern Ireland's 1958 had been a long time ago. And she was calling me up to see, get a little bit of flavour of what life was like in the foothills of the Andes in Mendoza, where I was. Because nobody'd ever heard of Mendoza then, though they know all about it now because of the wine. But I remember a phrase I used to her when she was asking me how it looked. I said, it all seemed to me remarkably normal. There's no having to open your shopping bag when you're going into a department store or anything like that. It was all just... There were lots of police about, but you'd expect that at a big major sporting event. It's the same anywhere.
When did you actually find out that you were going? What in terms of, like, I'm trying to think of timeline, because obviously you go into a World Cup for a commentator. There's a lot of prep that goes into that. So when did you actually get that letter?
It would have been around the turn of the year.
Okay.
There was plenty of time, but I was overwhelmed at the thought of it. And at the time, there was no internet. My full set of Rothmans football yearbooks, which was the vademecum for people like me. And it had to be carried with you as like a travelling library. Now it's just a laptop. But I pored over that book for evening after evening after evening, of course, and all the history that I could find about the World Cup. And I was very fortunate because RTE had decided that they would cover it geographically. So Jimmy McGee was in Buenos Aires and District Philip Green was in Cordoba. Billy George was kind of based in Buenos Aires, but travelling a bit near the capital. And I was in the far west in Mendoza. So I had 6 matches in 4 weeks. And who were the teams that I covered? There was Poland, there was Iran, there was the Netherlands that I'd done 76, there was Scotland, and there was Brazil. I did Brazil at my very first World Cup.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your first pick for this then, because it's an iconic moment in an iconic World Cup, but there is build up to this as well. So you picked out Archie Gemmell's goal against Netherlands. So just a little bit of background on Scotland at this World Cup. So Ali McLeod is the Scotland manager, and he essentially does no prep for this World Cup because he has such a good team. He's got Kenny Dalglish, Graham Souness, Alan Hansen, all coming off the back of European Cups. You've got John Walk and George Burnley had won the FA Cup with Ipswich. And they had 4 of Nottingham Forest's first division winning side. So he sees them as genuine contenders for this World Cup. So he doesn't need to do any prep. There's nothing to do for him. He gets offered the chance to go and see Peru, who's in his group. So they're in a group with Peru, Iran and Netherlands. He doesn't take the opportunity to go see Peru. And this tournament is nothing but a disaster, really, for Scotland.
Yeah.
Your first pick for this is Archie Gemmell's goal against Netherlands, which comes in the final game in the group stage.
When they're out?
For Scotland. They're already out.
Yeah.
But we've actually got a video of this if we want to take a look.
Gemmell. Good play by Gemmell. And again. 3-1! A brilliant individual goal by this hard little professional has put Scotland in dreamland. The miracle is beginning to happen. They need one more to qualify.
And the miracle did not happen.
No.
Because that goal put them 3-1 up, mm-hmm. and they go on to win the game 3-2. But that crucial goal from Netherlands
sends them out. That was the goal that put them out. They were on a hiding to nothing, really, because they had, as you say, blown it before that. And it was going to take this remarkable result to kind of put them through. But try as they might and score a goal like that, as they did, it just wasn't enough because the Netherlands came back and ended the dream. But to have the opportunity to commentate on a goal like that, as you can imagine, is something else. And Jimmy McGee had the same kind of thing happen in Argentina-England in 86 when Maradona got the ball around about the halfway line and beat one player, a different class, beat another player, a different class. And by now he's about to shoot and he shoots and he scores. He's a different class. I mean, just wonderful, wonderful commentary moment.
In terms of the Scotland one, the thing that stands out to me there is that Archie Gemmell's 31 when he does that, and looking at him now, a 31-year-old's look a lot different now.
Yeah.
what's your memory of that Scotland team at that tournament and the Ali McLeod situation? Is there a, when you're watching them at the tournament and they've got all these fantastic players in the background with Ali McLeod, is there a moment where the press box are almost thinking, what on earth is going on with this team?
Yeah, well, that was exactly the feeling, because we all kind of bought into this idea that Scotland were going to be special at this World Cup, and the fact that it had turned out that they weren't so special at all, that they were a collection of top players, but they weren't a team, basically, is what it was. And going into this against the Netherlands, the surprise factor was that they did so well that they actually got to 3-1 up in that game and were nearly believing that they could do it. But something told you at the back of your mind, they're not, that this was just kind of going to be a wonderful swan song, that it was too good to be true, and so it turned out.
It was a moral victory as such.
Yeah. Well, an actual moral victory.
Yeah. in terms of that team, so that Scotland team had come in pretty fancied because they'd qualified. They'd beaten Czechoslovakia in the qualifiers, who were the European champions at the time. So you can understand why they would be optimistic, but obviously fail to prepare to fail.
Indeed. Oh, it was just one of those things that Ali McLeod had a way about him that he felt that there was no way he could possibly fail, as Enda put it. We don't need to prep too much here. We're as good as anybody else. But of course, that wasn't how it transpired. And it's just one of those things that you get to the World Cup and then you blow it. I don't think they're going to do that this time, but they did certainly on that occasion.
And of course, this is followed by glorious failure at every World Cup for Scotland. It's almost a running joke now that even this Scotland team, which has a collection of really good players, obviously not as good as the 78 team, but there is a fair chance that Scotland also go out of the group stage this time.
Yeah, well, indeed. Even allowing for the fact that nearly everybody in the group stage is going to go through.
If anyone could mess it up, though.
Yeah, I know. There's a history there, isn't there? But I also think there's a steeliness about Scotland. Now, you look at players like Andy Robertson, look at John McGinn. You know, the players who've done it, I don't think they're going to blow it to that extent this time. But they're hardly going to win it. But I don't think they're going to blow it.
I don't think so. Well, we turn to the 1982 World Cup.
Yeah, which is Scotland again.
Brazil against Scotland is your pick for this. But just in the build-up to this World Cup, the key context for this is that it's the first time they've added 24 teams. Mm-hmm. It comes up from 16. And there was actually a group draw made. And it was reminiscent of when the Nations League was first announced and nobody could get their head around it at all. There's a great video from the BBC that we have here of this draw and the confusion, because it involves Scotland as well, because they mess up the draw in the build-up to this World Cup.
Herr Neuberger is opening that. We might be able to detect a particular colour of it. And it's Scotland. It's Scotland have been drawn against the favourites, Brazil, in Malaga and Seville. Well, would you believe it?
Escocia.
And that is almost a repeat of what happened to Germany in 1974 when Scotland were drawn.
Tres, numero 10.
And they've been given number. There it is. I'm sorry, It is a second seat, I beg your pardon. It is a second seat in Alicante. It is Alicante, in fact. Scotland have been drawn in Alicante along with Argentina. The information just getting to us there from down by was a bit slow. I'm sorry about that, but that was Scotland drawn against Argentina. And it does strike me that that would be the opening game of the entire tournament. I really do think there's been confusion down there because they're going back with the ball. They're not too happy about that. And there is confusion about what is going on. The information given to us, at least it seemed to come out at first, that Scotland were in Brazil section. That's how it looked to us from here. But the name has been put up there in Argentina's section. Yes, I thought so. There has been a mistake.
B, dans le tambour B. Nous allons mettre
there has been a mistake.
Le premier tiré dans le groupe 3 et le deuxième tiré dans le groupe 6.
I'm just
ça
listening
veut dire
to this just
la
now.
Belgique avec ira dans le groupe numéro 3.
And I think
et nous allons tirer
that Belgium, they're going back to Belgium. I'm pointing out a mistake about Belgium. Yes, that strikes me as correct, actually. Belgium should have been in Argentina section, as I first said, and Scotland should have been in Brazil section. I mean, that was the way it was arranged prior to the draw. That's what they said they were going to do.
Yeah, so if you thought Kevin Kilbane's description of the Nations League was bad, that was the official World Cup draw with a very young-looking Sepp Blatter.
Oh, yeah. Goodness me, brought back the memories already. He looked very young, didn't he? Too young to be in charge of that.
Yeah, so they completely messed it up. Mm. They didn't know themselves how it was supposed to work. I think it was just overly complicated the way they did, because at this World Cup, there was two group stages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
how,
right.
How was that? How did you get your head around all this?
With great difficulty. But it meant that I got to do Northern Ireland at the World Cup, because they in the second group stage, they were playing Austria and France, I think it was, put them out. But my memory, we were on talking about Scotland. The fans seemed to have got their heads around the fact that there was potentially another glorious failure coming up, because their song, the fan song at the time was, "I'm taking Malaga to Malaga," because they were based in the south of Spain. And I was assigned, working with Radio 2 BBC at the time, I was assigned to Scotland for the first group stage. And there's a nice story about that, if I may digress, the deal was that you stayed with your team until they got knocked out and then you went home. So I was given Scotland to cover, and my colleague Alan Green, who was only recently in Radio 2 Sport from Belfast, he was given Northern Ireland. But I was the guy in London, he was the guy from Manchester. I was in head office. So when it came to the bit and Scotland got knocked out, I was assuming I'd go home. And my wife was staying at Alan Green's house with his wife. And the word came through from London. Alan would have been staying on because Northern Ireland qualified. Word came through from London that I was to stay on and move to Northern Ireland. And Alan, as the junior partner, was being sent home. Which, of course, didn't only have ramifications for my relationship with Alan, because he was convinced that I had done this, but it also put my wife in a very strange position in Manchester with Brenda, Alan's wife. She had to kind of extract herself from this arrangement before Alan came home with smoke coming out of his ear. So anyway, that was that. But Scotland, as I say, set up for another glorious failure. And we were based down in San Roque. I was working with Frank McClintock, the great Arsenal double-winning captain, who became a great friend, because I did a lot of matches with him for BBC Radio. And we went to Scotland again. We're up against it. They're playing Brazil. And the match was in Seville. So we had a long car drive from where we were staying in San Roque, Guadalcorte, near Gibraltar, up to Seville for the match. And the match took place in the Real Betis Stadium. And believe it or not, Scotland took the lead. They had a midfielder called David Neary, who played for Dundee United, who had been European Cup semi-finalists the year Liverpool won it. They got knocked out by Roma. So Dundee United were a very strong team, Jim McLean, the manager. And Neary scored the goal. And I'll never forget that beside me in the commentary area was the David Francy of BBC Radio Scotland. You can imagine the excitement he generated when the goal went in. Absolutely super drive by David Neary! 1-0 Scotland! We're on our way! They weren't. They lost 4-1.
Score too early, George. I think
that's it.
There's that saying where I think we score too early. They obviously woke Brazil up.
Yes, exactly.
They poked the bear.
yeah. But it was brilliant. I mean, it was absolutely sensational. And then, of course, we had the situation where I was staying in a hotel near Barajas Airport. Well, I was staying. The BBC were staying. And it was the hotel also had the Spanish team in it, which was a bit odd. That was, you know, in the days when, in terms of Irish teams, we travelled with the team, we stayed with the team, all of that. So the Spanish World Cup team was in our hotel playing the World Cup. And then, of course, they left to go to Valencia to play Northern Ireland. And I was keen to watch Valencia that night and to see how Northern Ireland would get on. And the hotel had laid on in its conference room a big screen. And it was like a cinema because it was all in darkness as everybody watched the match. So I was going down to the match and I'd said to Frank McClintock, would you come down and watch it with me? So Frank said, no, I'm not feeling great. I'm just going to watch it in my room. So I went down and I sat in this room full of Spaniards. And of course, Gerry Armstrong scored the goal. Mal Donaghy got sent off. It became very tense. The crowd around me in this darkened room were getting very, very agitated. And I was having to keep my counsel because who knew what might have happened.
Did you let her roar when Gerry scored?
Of course it did. And they all looked at me. At least it was dark. But anyway, I was aware in this darkened room that the door opened, this shaft of light came in. And I automatically kind of turned, natural reaction. And I could see a figure in the door. It was Frank. And So I waved at him, let him see where I was, and he came across, and he shuffled in, and he sat down beside me and said, I couldn't leave you here on your own. I could not leave you here on your own among all those Spaniards. None of them are going to win. So you know why I look back on that with fondness, with that particular World Cup with fondness?
Was there much of a difference, did you find, from the South American World Cup and the European World Cup?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What was the key?
Well, I think it was possibly as much to do with the fact that I only experienced Mendoza in the World Cup in Argentina. I was only in one venue, but I was at many venues in Spain. I was in Seville, I was in Malaga, I was in Madrid, I was at Atletico Madrid where Northern Ireland played, I was in the Bernabeu, you know, so I was in Barcelona. I did the third or fourth place playoff in Barcelona. So, you know, it was experiencing the whole of the Spanish football experience, global Spain, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It was different. It was very, very, very different. It was, I really felt I was at the World Cup when I went to Spain.
You see quite a few journalists talk about it now. I know it's a different world being a journalist now to what it was back then, but you almost get a sense that some of them don't enjoy it because it is so relentless. You're going from venue to venue, you're going from city to city. Mm-hmm. Did you find that at all, or were you still almost...
Well,
complaining.
I was certainly far too early on to be complaining, and I didn't find it in any way as it wasn't as relentless then with the 24 teams as it ultimately became with the 32. But I didn't have that feeling. In fairness, I was part of a big team, so I wasn't. Journalists, you know, the written press tend to be on their own and tend to be having to flit from one to the other because they're covering virtually the whole thing. I mean, just as I've said, I was covering Scotland. Mm. And then when Scotland were out, I was covering Northern Ireland. And then I was kind of assigned. And I had a week off before the third and fourth place match because there weren't matches for me. So the relentlessness factor did not kick in to any extent really for me.
Did you stay for the entirety of the tournament?
I was home in Wimbledon where we lived at the time for the final. It was one of those kind of pinch me moments where I'm sitting in front of the television and I was on my own because I'd been away. So my wife was back home and with our family in Dublin.
And
she gets sent home.
She gets sent home. Yeah, she gets sent home. She did come out to join me for part of it.
And were tensions high then when you got back, or was everything
No tension. She was fine. She was absolutely fine. The fact that I'm no longer married to her is neither here nor there. There's nothing, nothing to do with that. But it was just domestically with a young daughter, and it was easier for her to be at home with her family with the child, who was not yet a year old, than to be with hanging around Wimbledon waiting for me to come home. So I arrived back home on the Saturday. Or whatever, maybe it was even the Sunday, the day of the game. It would have been the day of the game because I'd done the third and fourth place match the day before. Anyway, the surreal feeling sitting in front of the television in Wimbledon, watching the World Cup final with David Coleman commentating and thinking, I was actually there. I've been at the World Cup. It was, I think then it really, really, really hit me that I'd been part of this World Cup experience.
Just on the role of a commentator, now like we're on starting the World Cup, so many teams, so many players, pronunciations, all this. Like, but it's a lot easier to get pronunciations now. You can go anywhere in the internet. You'll have an interview with the player. You'll probably have a video of the player himself saying his own name.
Yeah.
Whereas you didn't have that luxury.
No, we didn't.
So how did you?
Well, my way of doing it. Bear in mind, my background is in languages, so I was always keen to get it right. But the German, the French, the Spanish, the Italian. The Portuguese weren't an issue because I had that, but there were others that were, and the best thing I found to do was to try and seek out the local commentator, so that I learned this from 78 when I was with the Dutch who were in Mendoza, and I became friendly with some of the Dutch broadcasters and still friends with them after all these years. It was almost put on a plate for me because they were talking the names of these players, and it was easy for me to pick up on that. And through that, I then kind of learned, you know, if you've a difficulty, find the commentator who's from the country and let him run through the team with you. And invariably, I would get people with Ireland. Is it McGrath or McGrath? Is it Moran or Moran? And they would come to just check. I was the one who got John Motson to say Paul McGrath's name and Kevin Moran's name correct.
Well, people are still saying Moran.
Yeah, there you go.
They haven't learned their lesson yet.
No, but anyway, on that subject, we were in Nuremberg in the 06 World Cup, and the Netherlands were playing, and they brought in a new centre forward. And when the team sheet came, and I looked at it, I hadn't a clue how to pronounce this name. And I looked all around for the Dutch, and they were nowhere to be seen. Like, they must have been at the other end of the commentary area. So I had a brainwave, and I left the position, and I went out onto the concourse behind the stand, and I found a Dutchman and, you know, all the gear. I said, how do you pronounce this name? And it didn't sound right, and I thought he might be taking the mick. So I found another Dutchman, and when the third Dutchman had confirmed the name, I felt confident in saying Dirk Kuyt. And there it was, Kuyt. I had no idea how to say it, but that's how I got there.
Still have people calling him Kuyt.
Yeah.
You sure do. All right, we'll move on to the next selection, which is Mexico 86. And as you mentioned this before, this is remembered for Diego Maradona and Jimmy McGee's different class.
Enrique to Maradona. Different class.
That's probably one of the more iconic commentaries in Irish history.
Yeah.
Because it just sums up what Diego Maradona was at this World Cup.
Yeah, but there's the art of the commentator. Jimmy McGee, not afraid of a silence. You know, it's a television commentary. You can see what's happening. And the words he chose, the two words he chose and said three times, just summed it up absolutely. And in a nutshell, that's what TV commentary is about. And you listen to commentators now and they're telling you about guys' backgrounds and where they came from.
What they had for breakfast.
It drives me bonkers.
They have like a pre-written line that they knew.
Yeah. And you said, for goodness sake, shut up. I want to watch the match.
Well, you, like the crossover of radio, you have to describe absolutely everything.
Yes.
So then, I did it the other way. I did TV stuff and I was told the same as just the pictures are there. They can see it. You don't need to talk. Whereas radio, then I went in and then saying to me, you need to talk more.
Yeah, you need to keep it going.
Yeah.
You're going to lose your listener. No, the picture is there. And
I think so. Too many commentators are scared of silence. Television commentators are afraid of a silence because they think they'll be judged on not having added enough. But I mean, I rest my case with Jimmy McGee's commentary there.
Where do you fall on the debate of commentators giving their own opinions on things? Because we were actually having this debate in the office where, like, a lot of modern commentators, it's almost like a podcast at times between himself and the co-commentator, whereas if you listen back to some of the older style, it's very much calling what you see on the pitch as opposed to what you think the player should be doing on the pitch.
Well, my view was always, and would remain so, that if I've got a former player beside me, there is no way I'm going to trump his knowledge of what is actually happening. I may have an idea, but I always try to couch what I would say in terms that would complement what the co-commentator might be about to say. But I would never have gone down the line of telling Ray Houghton that that's what he should have done to invite Ray to come back and say, you're an idiot, you know, because that's basically what it's about. That's why you're there. You're there because you have a facility to do different class. And he's there, or she's there, to add what they know from having been down there facing the different class.
Yeah.
So what value is the commentator's notion? And we're back to the, for goodness sake, shut up. You
know? What's your memories of 86 then in general?
Well, 86 was a funny one because Tim O'Connor was by now the head of sport and he was out in Mexico with the commentary teams kind of moving between them because we were based a bit like 78 in location. So I was given Mexico City and Stephen Alkin was given Guadalajara. And I had a producer, Max Mulvihill. Stephen was producing, not commentating, but he was with Jimmy McGee in Guadalajara. So Tim was with Max Mulvihill and myself in Mexico and we were doing the rounds of the matches. And eventually, 2 weeks, 3 weeks in, Tim thought, I'd better go and see how the lads are getting on in Guadalajara. And he got to Guadalajara and he did his recce and he came back and he said, this is absolutely ridiculous. We're down here in the smog. You can't sunbathe after midday because the sun's no longer visible. They're up there in Spanish colonial style with a swimming pool and a wonderful hotel. I'm switching you about. And he brought Jimmy and Stephen to Mexico and sent Max and me to Guadalajara. And he was right. It was absolutely sensational, this Hacienda of a place that they were staying in. But what that meant, I was able to do a match in Guadalajara that, for me, was one of the best World Cup matches I've ever had the privilege to commentate on. It was France against Italy. I think it was a quarter final, maybe. But the thing about it was
France-Brazil.
Did I say France-Italy?
Yeah,
I meant France-Brazil.
Yeah,
that's why your face went strange.
Yeah, I'm nearly certain it was France-Brazil.
I am absolutely certain it was France-Brazil because France were not fancy to progress, but they were playing very well. It was the great European Championship team of 1984. And Brazil made a substitution. They sent on Zico. And shortly after they sent Zico on, they got a penalty. And they gave it to Zico to take. And I remember thinking at the time and saying it, you know, that surely this is madness because he's hardly up to the speed of the game. And Joel Batts, the goalkeeper, saved the penalty. Anyway, the penalty was not scored. It ended in a 1-1 draw. Ultimately went to penalties and France won the shootout. And, you know, that it was just such a magnificent occasion. It was my first real experience of the two really, really, really good teams, champions of Europe, and Brazil going head-to-head and the European team winning it, which was just, it was quite sensational and it's lived with me ever since as possibly the best World Cup match I've ever seen.
When I was looking back at this game, John Motson says at the start, could penalties be on the cards? And in some of the match reports or some of the as you were, the BBC had, I highly doubt it because there's only been one penalty shootout ever at the World Cup before. So this was only the second ever penalty shootout that we saw at a World Cup. And Socrates steps up first, he misses. Then Michel Platini, he steps up and hits probably one of the worst penalties in the World Cup.
What a birthday Platini is having today.
So that was Platini on his birthday, of all days.
No shin guards back then.
No. John Motson there. It's funny when you look back in the match, the audio or the fans are so fervent at the game that you can barely hear him call it.
Yeah.
Because it was such a big moment.
Yes.
But ultimately, France do go on to win this match. As a commentator, when you're getting ready for that penalty shootout, like, what's going through your mind? Because it's, as a fan, it's such a dramatic moment and it's such a big moment, but you have to be present as the commentator for those.
Yeah, it's fierce. You're struck down with fear almost, because there is the awful feeling that you might get this wrong, because it happens relatively quickly. And, you know, they score or they don't score, and jiggling all this around in your head as to who is doing well, it's not quite as straightforward as it seems. And the great fear is that you've missed the moment that this kick is going to be the decisive one, and they score and the celebrations are on and you haven't got it. That's the big fear, that you may mess it up. And as you say, because I'd never commentated, obviously, in a penalty shootout before, so it was something that filled me with dread as it unfolded, but thankfully I got to the end of it.
And a new challenge as well, I guess, coming up with a new thing to say with each penalty, because you don't want to be like, goal, goal, miss, goal. You almost, you have to be...
Like the walk-up.
Description about it.
Players take a long time to walk up.
Yeah.
And they actually sprinted towards the ball back in those days when they were hitting the penalties.
Yes.
It was a completely different thing.
Apart from Panenka in 76.
Of course, yeah.
But I wasn't there. I wasn't there.
Were you at the World Cup final in 86 as well?
That was my first World Cup final.
That was your first World Cup.
Yeah, and I remember thinking, because...
What a final to be your first.
Yeah, again, we're all there together. Max and Tim and Jimmy McGee was there. Jimmy was in the commentary box with me for that. What was my first final? It would have been the first one that he hadn't done, you know. And he was there. He took part in it, but he didn't actually do the commentary. But he did take part in the broadcast, because Tim didn't want to, you know, just say you're not doing it. You know, that Tim was a great man for managing the situation in every way. But anyway, I remember we drove to the game in our hire car. Tim at the wheel with Max, Jimmy and myself, no co-commentator. And we got to the outer cordon at the Aztec Stadium, and this guy with a machine gun, a policeman, was there ready to see us into the press car park. And Tim engaged him in conversation, which involved blurted words that weren't quite Spanish, but making the case that we were much more important than the people who went into the press car park. And this negotiation with the machine gun toting policeman actually worked. And we were ushered through into not the VVIP, but the VIP car park. And I was just agog at the brazenness of what he had just done. And off the back of that, we get out of the car and we're right up by the stadium. And I looked up at the Azteca Stadium, I think, you know, we're going in here, and in 3 hours' time, the eyes of the world will be on this place, and I'm going to be in there. And it was just one of those pinch-me moments. My very first World Cup final, and it was sensational, yeah.
Was there any point, you're sort of describing it there, but was there a point where you're looking at the Azteca Stadium and you're thinking, I'm just a boy from Belfast here.
Yeah.
I'm here at the biggest game in history.
That's exactly, you've summed it up, exactly. That is exactly, wee man for the Craigie Road. And he's about to go into the Azteca Stadium in Mexico City for the biggest game of the world.
Excitement, but any like nerves as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But what I think it was either Terry Wogan or Eamon Andrews described it. It's not actually nerves. It's broadcast anxiety. So there was a lot of broadcast anxiety going into the Azteca that day.
What's the situation going on between yourself and the likes of Jimmy McGee in terms of, like, there's no co-commentator for this game, so who takes the lead?
He commented before, during, and after.
Right.
But he didn't actually commentate on the match.
So you took the game.
Yeah, I took the game, because we didn't have co-commentators on a regular basis back then. We had a co-commentator at the European Championship final in 1980, because Owen Hand, the newly appointed Irish manager, was out. And he'd ended up, for a lot of long story, it's in the book, he ended up staying with us in Rome. And we bluffed him into the stadium for the final. And having got him in, we thought, well, we may as well use him. And we did. And he'd never broadcast before. It was comical thinking back on it. But we didn't regularly have co-commentators back then.
Yeah, God, different times. You'd do well to sneak anybody in.
Oh, no chance.
To any game at this stage, let alone the World Cup final. So this is the 86 World Cup final between Argentina and Germany. Mm. And it's
West Germany.
For all intents and purposes, it's a fantastic game as well. Mm. You know, Jose Brown opens the scoring, Jorge Valdano scores the second to put Argentina 2-0 up. And then Karl-Heinz Rummenigge pulls one back, and Rudi Völler then scores with just 6 minutes left or 7 minutes left on the clock to set up this stellar last 6-7 minutes. Argentina take the lead through Jorge Burruchaga.
Burruchaga.
I think there's six, 7 minutes left, and then it's Diego Maradona's crowning moment, and forever he lives on in memory. Are you aware of the gravity of that situation when you see Diego Maradona lifted and hoisted on people's shoulders? And
oh yes, I mean it is the World Cup final.
Aside from that, that
trumps everything. I think that you know the significance of the moment because of what you've gone through, and all the broadcast anxiety and the whole Azteca Stadium. It's just the whole thing is so monumental that you can't fail to be moved by what it is that you've just seen and peripherally been a part of.
But the idea of Maradona himself, what I'm asking is, in the moment, are you aware that this guy is going to be a deity forever now?
Oh.
Or was it just the fact that it was the World Cup final?
I think it's just at that moment, it was just the fact that it was the World Cup final, because I don't know that you would have the capacity to reflect that this is going to be the moment that will live on forever about this particular guy. I think that comes afterwards when you're thinking back and when you're having a beer that night, maybe, but not in the moment.
If you look over your shoulder there, and you'll see it there in the World Cup 90 folder.
There he is.
Mr. Maradona.
Yeah. That's actually, I must crack that book open before.
that's actually, George, that's mine. And
have you donated it?
I walk the ball? No. If I go, that goes as well. That's kind of how I'm staying here. But there's a few little gems in there.
Can you see it?
Jack Charlton's autograph is in there.
Right.
But also the great and late, unfortunately, Toto Scarlatti.
Oh, yeah.
Was in and saw it, and he donated his signature to it. Paul McGrath's one is in there as well, because he was the first autograph that I got. It arrived in my letterbox one night, which, because of where we're not far from Dalkey United, so my dad obviously knew somebody there, and it was there's a letter for a 7-year-old at the door, it was Paul McGrath's one. Yeah.
There's actually some phenomenal World Cup memorabilia in this studio that a lot of people might not know. This one sits behind Jer every day, and it's a wooden ball that was given to the Irish team. And they sent it all around 2002 at the Korea-Japan World Cup.
Oh, right.
One signature missing.
Oh.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
He had gone home at this point. Yeah. So Kevin Kilbane donated that one.
Right. That's amazing, yeah.
We need another few podcasts for
absolutely
to go into that one.
You do want to talk about the 98 World Cup final, but we'd be remiss if we skipped some World Cups in between there, because Ireland finally make it to a World Cup.
Well, indeed. But I thought, when you asked me to come up with a few memories, the Irish memories are well rehearsed. I suppose it's perfectly okay to go there again. But I was thinking more in terms of, they would obviously mean so much to me that there had to be others, and that's why I left them out.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, of course, I mean, the greatest World Cup moment for me was clearly in Genoa that afternoon when the nation held its breath.
Well, we actually, of course, we had to pull out this.
This kick can decide it all. The nation holds its breath. Yes, we're there!
And just like that, forever, you have your different class moment.
It's funny, there are things that you can't possibly manufacture, because it's dependent upon whatever the action presents for you to comment on, and it's exactly similar circumstance to what Jimmy had back in 86.
having been to all the different World Cups from the 70s up until the 90s now, what was your experience with Italy in general and the Irish diaspora heading over there and everyone taking planes, trains and automobiles over and experiencing that when your nation is actually at the World Cup, having been to ones that they weren't? Well, I know Northern Ireland was at some of the World Cups you commentated on as
well. Yeah, but this was of an entirely different nature because there were so many more involved. Like it's a bigger, representing a bigger football association, the Irish diaspora. And there'd never been any of this before 88, in Euro 88. And what struck me then was, you know, so much sport in Ireland is locally based, and the most popular sport in the GAA, it's all county based. So you wear your county colours. And I mean, that's so obvious nowadays that people proudly wear their county colours, even if it's not in the county. You know, I often wonder what the Kerry shirts are doing knocking about Belfast, but maybe that's because Kerry are so successful. Anyway, leaving that to one side, there had never been an opportunity to wear a green shirt and say, I'm Irish. And Germany gave him that. And Germany kind of came about, kind of crept up on us, I think, in a way, because we didn't actually qualify ourselves. It took it was another match that made the table work for us, and away we went. But the World Cup being, well, won the World Cup, and we'd made it for the first time. But also we'd had our kind of trial run in Germany on a two-week tournament. And now this was a big, big, much bigger thing. So many, many more people went. And it's just to see the sea of green. Like, my World Cup experience had taught me that fans of countries go dressed up in the colours of the country. So the Dutch wear orange boiler suits, and the Swedes all go in yellow and blue. And so you see these people marching to matches, and they're wearing the colours, and it's just a sea of whatever colour it is. And now there was a sea of green. And it was so obvious that they bought into the whole World Cup experience, which involves dressing up in your country's colours. And it was just wonderful to see.
We had the inflatable shamrocks. They were the big ones for 1990. I remember Euro 88, but 1990 just was a different level where, just even looking at that clip of Paddy Bonner in his grey jersey, obviously the yellow jersey that he wore in the other games, the green jersey which we wore, the white one against the Dutch. I think I had all four jerseys. Jerseys were expensive.
Before they weren't 120.
No, they weren't. Yeah. They weren't as relative, obviously, but they weren't as expensive as they are now. But yeah, like everywhere around the place, bunting everywhere, it was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I have to, there's obviously younger lads in the office who never got to experience it, and it was just incredible.
Well, it's one of those tournaments that I'm too young. I wasn't born for Italia 90, but it feels like I was, and it feels like I experienced it because you experience it through the memories of people that were at it or had seen it or reeling in the years that was always on in households every weekend. Mm. And you felt like you were part of it, even though I wasn't even born. I was but a thought.
Well, Donegal obviously played a key role in that as well.
Yeah. Well, Paddy Bonner forever is a legend in the county as a result. So, phenomenal stuff. All right. Will we do the 1998 World Cup final? Well,
the World Cup final, it was Brazil, of course, and France. And we're in the stadium. Stade de France is one of my favourite venues because it's for the press, it's a doddle. You're straight in off the concourse, up two flights of stairs, and you're on the corridor that has one side the press room and on the other side the gangway to the commentary or press seats. So it's really, really easy place to negotiate. It's really user-friendly. So you go into the press room and you have a sandwich and a coffee. And then when it's time, you go and take your seat in the stand. So we've done all that. We're in the stand, myself and Jim Beglin, ready to go for the final. We're probably a good hour before the match kicks off, and the atmosphere is great. And the team sheet comes round. And the way it was, the 22, I think there were 22 players in the squad at the time. And the squad had several columns, three columns down the side beside the two names. So one team's on top, the other team's below. So one sheet of paper and 44 names and three columns. And one X is in the column for those who are playing, X is for those who are on the bench, and X is for those who are absent. And so the teams are, they're not in formation, it's just a list of names. So I have my chart that I've worked on and my my predicted team is on it, so I'm going to have to make changes and get the little stickers out and put them over the name of the player who's not involved that I thought would be involved. Jim Beglin is looking at it with a different eye, and he says all of a sudden, Ronaldo's not playing. Ronaldo's not playing. I said, what? And I looked, and sure enough, there he wasn't.
Yeah.
There he wasn't. I said, what? And so we kind of looked around, and nobody had twigged this. So I said, Jim, we have time. I'm going to go out and see if I can find out. And I went back out into the press room, which, as I say, was only just across the corridor. And any face I recognised, I said, any idea why Ronaldo isn't playing? And, of course, they hadn't been out front. And they, what? He's not playing? You know, so nobody knew. Nobody knew what was going on. So I went back out to the front, to my seat, with no answer to this conundrum as to why Ronaldo wasn't playing. And next thing, I get a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around, and it's Yannick Noah, the tennis player, who's in the seat behind, because he's, believe it or not, co-commentating for French TV. And he just happens to be in the seat behind me. So I'm the one he tells, Ronaldo's in, Ronaldo's in. And with that, a lady from the press staff comes out waving her arms frantically saying, new team sheet, new team sheet, new team sheet. So we really don't know what went on. It was said he had a seizure during the night and that he wasn't fit. And the suggestion was that Nike, the sponsors, insisted that he had to play. But we never really got to the bottom of it. But that was the sequence. And that's why I remember the 98 World Cup final. Quite apart from Laurent Blanc's kiss on the head. Fabien Barthez.
Even though he was suspended, he still came out, right? And that's what the lads do before the show. They give me a kiss on the head.
I considered it, but I thought it might be.
It's okay, Chris.
Do you still have the team sheet?
I do, somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I kept all that stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. It's in a box in the roof space somewhere.
There's room on the shelf for one.
The silly thing is that it when you keep all these things and then you don't know where they are after years, you know. Yeah. I know I have it, but it would take a long time to find it. Somebody'll find it after I'm gone and say, "Oh, there it is."
And sometimes you think that, you know, they're, it's a mess. No, why am I keeping, why do I have all these press passes? Yeah. What's the point? Yeah. They're just taking up room. But, I mean, that was such an outrageous one that, like, you have to keep that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you have much more memorabilia from across the World Cups?
Oh, yeah. I have lanyards and all sorts. It was just something I always felt, you know, this might be your last one. You better hold on to it, you know.
This World Cup final is the French Revolution of football. Mm-hmm. It births a new era for France football, and you have the Zizou for president.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, scores two headers in this game. France go on to demolish Brazil, really, and this is a fantastic Brazil side. Mm-hmm. And Ronaldo and Rivaldo and Roberto Carlos, and they go on to win the World Cup in 2002 mm-hmm. with Ronaldo being the star again. But, I mean, what was it like being in? I think that France were only the second nation to win it on their debut of hosting the tournament.
Yeah, it was quite sensational because the tournament began very quietly. There was a kind of a French auteur about it. This World Cup, Le Mondial, pourquoi? And the general shrugs of the shoulders at what this, we don't. I mean, there was no big time Paris Saint-Germain at the time. Bear in mind, Marseille was a big team. Saint-Étienne had been a big team. Paris, no. Until France started to look like they might go somewhere, and it picked up a momentum all its own. So by the time the final came around, it was crazy, absolutely crazy. And we went out after the final. We went to dinner in a lovely restaurant called Le Bœuf sur le Toit, the bull on the roof. And we had a lovely dinner. We'd booked it weeks in advance because we knew it would be difficult after the match to. And after we had our dinner, we emerged about, one in the morning? And it was nuts. Paris, you couldn't move for people. It was just crazy. And the metro had stopped. You'd think they might have kept the metro going all night, but no, the metro had stopped. And there were people sleeping in the doorway of the metro stations because the gates were across. And the Champs-Élysées, you could hardly walk down it for the people that there were. Certainly no vehicular traffic. And, of course, to get a taxi, we were living in suburban Paris and flying out the next morning. What are we going to do? How are we going to get home? It's too far to walk. So we started walking anyway, and we came upon a hotel, and we thought, well, maybe they'll be able to get us a taxi. We'd left the crowds, you know, behind. We'd walked for half an hour. And we're in this hotel. It's now about 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. And we went up to the reception desk and asked, could they possibly help us by getting us a taxi? And there's no chance, absolutely no chance of taxis. We can't, there's no taxis. And there was an American guy checking out beside us on his way to the airport. And he heard us asking. He said, I have a taxi coming. I'll give you guys a lift if it's on the way to the airport. So our hotel magically became on the way to the airport. He was none the wiser. But that was how we got back after the final.
Well, you have to be resourceful. And it sounds like all these stories, you have to be resourceful, and you were. And I suppose if you don't ask, you don't get.
This is very true. This is very true.
And it's definitely anybody who's been, I guess, working at a match abroad or working at a major tournament knows that, you know, there is that element of playing up the Paddy Irishman charm a little bit as well to get what you want from some of the locals.
Well, I told the Tim O'Connor story about getting into the VIP car park in Mexico City. That is a fact. You do have to be resourceful, and if you don't have your wits about you, you're not gonna make it. Basically,
just as we kind of draw a conclusion to this, then, is there a memory or a World Cup that you could pick out that you think, yeah, I think that's the one that I will remember forever. That's my favourite.
My favourite World Cup per se. Mm. Well, for personal reasons, it's Germany in 06. Because I'd lived in Germany, I'd done Euro 88 in Germany, the World Cup, I'd missed the 74 World Cup in West Germany because I hadn't started commentating at that stage. But 06 was so significant that after the reunification of Germany for 15 odd years before, this was the first opportunity the Germans had to kind of hoist a flag and say we're proud to be Germans. And they did that in a big way. Because it was Germany, it was a very well-run World Cup. They had Deutsche Bahn on board, the railway, as one of the sponsors, which meant it was dead easy for the fans to get around. The whole thing was just a magnificent experience. And to go to, you know, Leipzig, where the big old central stadium from the Soviet era was a listed building, so they built a new stadium inside it. So the actual main stadium, Red Bull Leipzig Stadium, is a modern stadium inside the walls of big Centralstadion that had been there before. That memory lives. Or arriving into Hamburg for a game and the dusk coming and night falling, and then seeing in all the tall buildings projections of goalposts and footballs. You know, they just took the whole thing to their hearts. And it was just a magnificent experience from start to finish. And to do the final end in Berlin was just... which is magical. Those memories, it kind of, because I had a familiarity with Germany and the way Germans do things, it just lives with me forever. The football wasn't half bad.
It was a great tournament football-wise, even actually just on that final, like Zidane, we've talked about his head in the 98 final. He used his head in a different way. I suppose when you're covering these games, George, you think you've seen it all.
Yeah.
And then something like that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, and it's you can't legislate for the moment. That's a very good way of putting it, actually. You think you've seen it all, and then you see something else.
You see something else. Yeah, I was speaking to Simon Cooper, the writer for the Financial Times. Mm. He's written a book about the World Cup. He's covered 9 of them. This will be his 10th. And the German one stood out to him as well because of that, as you mentioned, the reunification of Germany and some of the older Germans who lived through the war having that uncomfortability with German nationalism projected through football, and this almost being a rebirth of being actually, it's okay.
Yeah.
We're not in danger here. This is just football.
Yeah.
And you can sing Deutschland if you want, because at the end of the day, the whistle goes and the match is over.
Yes.
And everyone goes home and enjoys themselves.
Yeah.
In terms of the World Cup now, what's your feelings around it?
I think they're in the process of destroying it by making it something that it was never meant to be. There have been a number of articles written in recent days about how this World Cup is so different from anything that's gone before, and how it's been turned into an entertainment product as opposed to a football tournament.
Mm.
The disregard for the fans, not least in the nature of the hosting of it, in over three countries so far, distances so far apart. Now, obviously, every team won't be everywhere, but the getting to the United States or Mexico or Canada in the first place, and then the distances in between, and then the price gouging and all of that. The fans are way, way down the list of priorities mm-hmm. now from where they used to be. And I think, you know, the comment of Infantino, the FIFA president, that this is going to be the greatest tournament, there'll be 104 Super Bowls, it shows what he doesn't get about sport, because there can't be 104 Super Bowls. What makes a Super Bowl? I'm not a great fan of American football, but I understand that what makes a Super Bowl unique or so special is the fact that it's unique.
Yeah.
That there is only one in a year. If you have 104 of them, forget it.
Well, it's the age-old adage of, is that if everyone's special, nobody's special.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the case. I mean, it is that sense of, I mean, we played the audio or the video there of the World Cup draw when it was increased to 24 teams. Mm. Now we have double the amount of teams then, and it just seems like it's going to continue to grow until it eventually sort of eats itself. And we're sort of in the process of that.
And I think there's another point about this. If you think about why is it growing and why are there teams in it? And I won't name them because I don't want to be disparaging, but teams who would not be in the top 24 in the world are at this World Cup because there are 48 teams. Those teams represent federations who have a vote, and Gianni Infantino wants to get voted back in again. Mm. And if he is dispensing largesse in the way that he can because of the money that's made out of this tournament, he's going to get their votes, isn't he? I mean, it's that's the way it works. It's politics. It's not sport.
Just in terms of the actual games themselves, then it's changed so much. Even we haven't even talked about VAR, like how that has changed the role of a commentator, where we've talked about some great commentary moments in the last hour, but some of those could be made redundant because of VAR.
That's very true.
Which, you know, I like some people would argue, look, you get the right decision with VAR, but my point has always been, is it for the better of the game? And I've never thought it has been. And you get some great goals and they're disallowed because it flicked off somebody's fingernail. Yeah. Like I think back to Robbie Keane, you were there when he scored that great equaliser against Germany. VAR would have gone in to see if it came off his hand when Quinn flicked it down to him. It didn't, but they still would have checked for a minute. And all those celebrations we had where we absolutely lost ourselves, because that's the greatest feeling in football when your team scores a goal. We would have had to just reserve ourselves for another minute.
And then it's not the same.
No.
That's not the same. And there's the other thing. Football, according to the regulations, is a game of two halves, 45 minutes and 45 minutes. It has now become a game of four quarters in the World Cup because of the mandatory water break at 22 minutes in each half. And if you read the regulation, you'll see it also includes specific instruction to broadcast partners that they are to stay with the pictures until a certain point and that they are to be back with the pictures at a certain point before the game restarts. In other words, well, they can say all they want about looking after player welfare. It's all about getting the ads in.
Mm. The split screen. They did it during the Six Nations with the rugby.
Yeah, the split screen for the scrums.
Yeah, VAR.
They don't even have to split screen it.
Yeah.
Because the regulation is there saying they can leave.
Mm. Well, I think the next one will be they'll sponsor VAR, where the commentator will be told, we'll be back with the decision after the break.
I believe, I could be wrong, I can't remember the exact, there's a company, was it AT&T or one of those that sponsors the replays in NFL or previously sponsored, like it is a thing, it is that Americanization of football, and that's been a very purposeful thing that they've done with all the different board members and American businessmen coming over and taking over clubs as well. You see it all over the place. George, we're running out of time here. You've another interview to do after this. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been my pleasure.
It's been fantastic listening to you over the number of years that we have as well. So, like, in terms of we spoke about the beauty of nostalgia, like, you play a big role in that as well. So I hope you know that.
You're very kind.
What are you up to these days? You've got a podcast.
Yeah, we've got a podcast. It's funny. I went to get my hair cut one day and I was the only customer at the shop, and I was looking straight ahead into the mirror and in the corner of my eye, somebody came into the shop and he had a little kid with him, and he parked the kid behind me and then sat down in an adjacent chair and started to talk, and I recognised his voice from the radio. He's a DJ on Radio Ulster, Connor Phillips. And I said, is that the voice of Connor Phillips I hear? Because I couldn't look at him because I have my hair cut. And he said, he recognised my voice. And we started chatting, and we went and had a cup of coffee afterwards, and he had this notion for a podcast talking about football, basically, and talking with the stars, reminiscing a bit like this. And we called it It's There because of it's a comedy phrase. It's there! So it's wherever you get your podcast, it's there.
This is exactly what it says in the tin.
Absolutely. George, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With Viagra Connect 50 milligram film-coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
Rugby.
No, I've probably apologised for the first one. I think that's where you have to get rid of that in rugby. You know, tucked shoulder to the head. Because then guys aren't going to jackal, so, you know, that just, my only thing for Leo now was to say sorry for that.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.